I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. I was a child once, we all were, and I remember what I daydreamed about. It wasn't dinosaurs for me. For me, all the excitement in the world was connected with traveling either through the air or on the water. So my flights of fancy had to do with astronauts or pilots or seafaring types, just never pirates in my case, but that's a story for another day. Our next guest understands the flights of fancy children like to take, and for over a decade, she has worked in the world of school library publishing. Today, we're going to visit with her about her account of a group of 13 women who campaigned very hard to be included among NASA's first astronauts into space. This group of women called the Mercury 13. I'm delighted to introduce Rebecca Siegel to you. Rebecca, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you so much for having me. And I do want to say that as a child, I dreamed about astronauts and dinosaurs.
You included the dinosaurs, did you?
Yes, very much. Love a good dinosaur still to this day.
Well, you know, even your book title, it fits right into my memory of childhood dreams. And so I'm going to give that book title in just a moment. But first, I have to say, I noticed on your website, the first two content tabs at the top, one labeled fly and the other sail. And I really think you've tapped into something important there for kids.
Well, these are the two topics that I think are spectacularly interesting. They're both so adventurous, and I just have had the good fortune to write about these two things that are so exciting. The book that we're here to discuss, which is about space, but I also wrote a book last year about the Mayflower and that journey, its participants, and then the indigenous people that they encountered in America. So it's really, I'm very lucky to be able to write about such exciting, cool things all the time.
Do you kind of channel your inner teenager or child when you do this? Do you have to think like a kid?
That's a great question. And it's a little bit embarrassing to answer because no, I think my in my heart of hearts, I'm still 13. So I write naturally. It takes almost no effort for me to write for a middle grade audience. In fact, when I'm writing for adults, I'm constantly reminding myself like, okay, these are adults. These are grown-ups. They can handle a long sentence. I have to challenge myself when I'm writing for older audiences.
Well, I'm going to come through the back door to this story of the 13, the Mercury 13. I want to go ahead and talk about what did not happen before we discuss what did happen for these women. And maybe the best way to do this is to talk about July 2021, just behind us, the Blue Origins spacecraft. This connects with your story.
It does, and it is the most marvelous happy ending. So I'm sure most of your listeners were at least aware a little bit of what was going on. Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin launched the New Shepard spacecraft, and on board was an octogenarian named Wally Funk, which probably seemed like a strange choice to include on one of these pioneering space flights. But for those of us who are interested in aviation and space history, it was the perfect choice because Wally Funk had been trying to get herself into outer space since the early 1960s when she was among a group of 13 women who underwent some preliminary astronaut testing as part of a research project that was connected to Project Mercury, which was NASA's first crewed spaceflight program. So for Wally, when she got to enjoy those few minutes of weightlessness, it was really the culmination of just a lifetime of work and dreams.
Yeah. And were you perfectly aware of what was going down or going up when this happened?
I was. And I have to tell you, Wally is one of those people who has such a boisterous, joyful personality that when I was watching the flight, and you could hear some of the audio from inside the New Shepard, you could hear Wally like whooping and yelling and laughing. And it made my entire family smile because we know her so well. And that is how she is on the ground. And I was so delighted to hear her being so joyful up in the air as well.
So you say you know her so well. Are you talking about figuratively or have you actually spoken with her?
Oh, Wally and I would talk most, I would say a few times a week for the better part of while I was writing this book. So I would call her. Usually I'd put my kids to bed and then I'd call Wally. And I have to admit, at the beginning, it was purely for research. I was just, you know, asking her about her experience as an astronaut candidate and her experience as a pilot. But as the months turned into years, it was soon just a friendship. Wally is this really inspiring, incredible woman who has been through so much. You know, how many people do you know that have fought for something for 60 years and are still able to be in a good mood about it? You know, like she's, I have never met anyone who is as focused and joyful as Wally Funk.
You said she's fought for 60 years, and the word fight is actually in your subtitle. The full title of the book, To Fly Among the Stars, The Hidden Story of the Fight for Women Astronauts. Let's get into the story of that fight. You already mentioned sort of some testing, some rigorous testing that anybody who wanted to go up into space had to go through just to be selected in the first place. And women were actually at least that far into the game that they were subjected to this rigorous testing.
That's right. So to understand what Wally went through and to get a good idea of what was going on in the first days of NASA, it's helpful to sort of like go in the Wayback Machine and remember that in the late 1950s, early 1960s, spaceflight was this entirely new, untested frontier, right? We hadn't sent a human into space yet. And because of that, scientists and engineers didn't really know how it would impact a human being. You know, we had sent, you know, the Soviets had sent satellites up, they had sent a dog up, but what would happen to a human being in outer space was still a mystery. And so when NASA's astronaut selection committee decided to pick its first group of astronauts, there was this consensus that whoever they picked had to be in perfect physical and mental shape, they had to be brave, dedicated, and incredibly committed to this project, because the consequences were very scary. You know, this was something that was potentially life-ending, you know, getting involved in this. And so what this astronaut selection committee did was they decided, well, let's choose our first group of astronauts, not from just the general American public, even though that would have been an interesting proposition, it would have taken forever, because if they opened up applications to become astronauts to the entire country, they would have had millions of people responding, and it would have taken a long time to go through their applications and check their backgrounds and everything. And so out of an interest in being time conscious, because you remember this is the beginning of the space race as well, Soviets had launched Sputnik, there was pressure for the United States to be in competition with the Soviet Union. So NASA's astronaut selection committee said, okay, let's just do this. Let's choose our first astronauts from the nation's pool of active duty military test pilots. Because number one, that cuts the pool of applicants way down. But also, this is already a group of tested individuals. You know, we already know that they're physically fit. They're already proving their dedication to the country. And helpfully, we already have all their paperwork. So it's going to be easier and faster for us to sift through their applications. So the selection committee, you know, brings a group of these test pilots in, they get volunteers, and then they say, great, all you have to do now is make it through some health screening tests. And the astronaut or these pilots are like, great, no big deal. They show up to a health clinic in Albuquerque, New Mexico, thinking that they're going to go through a regular physical exam. But what followed was anything but. So what these pilots went through was a three-stage series of tests that were physical, mental, and emotional, essentially. And they basically ensured that these guys had nothing wrong with them. So the physical set of tests lasted a week. They were everything from heart scans to hearing tests. They made them display their lung strength. They had to run on a treadmill, ride on a bike. Then they went to, from that testing facility, they went to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio, where they underwent some psychological testing. They looked at ink blots. They ranked themselves versus their peers. They took isolation tests, where they had to sit in a room for a couple of hours just to make sure that they weren't going to freak out. And in the end, NASA chose seven guys to become the country's first astronauts. And these, they were soon called the Mercury Seven. And it's this group of like handsome, buttoned up military men. All of them were white. They were all married. They were all Christian. And the United States, truly, when they met these seven astronauts, the country fell in love with them. They were everything Americans were ready to embrace as a hero, right? They fit that Captain America bill. But what's really interesting is as those first seven astronauts started to train to become astronauts, because you remember they came into the program as pilots, so once NASA selected them, they had to go off to NASA and start learning the business of spaceflight, which was entirely different. So while that was happening, these two guys that were involved in their selection, one of them was an Air Force person, Brigadier General Donald Flickinger, and the other was a civilian named Dr. Randy Lovelace. These two guys had sort of put their heads together and started wondering, are we doing the right thing in selecting men? And beyond that, they were sort of wondering, should we be looking into the women, to the idea of women astronauts? And their reason for this is, it sounds really like groundbreaking and progressive, but really they were just being practical, because this was in the days when every additional pound that an astronaut weighed required 1,000 pounds of rocket fuel. So engineers at NASA were really hard at work trying to strip the weight of the space capsule, this tiny little contraption that was going to sit on top of a rocket, to get it to be as light as possible, to reduce that payload. And so these two doctors, Flickinger and Lovelace, were looking at each other like, well, why don't we select a lighter astronaut? You know, if a woman could weigh 20, 40, 60 pounds less than a man, wouldn't that be a convenient help for these rocket scientists? And beyond that, women were shown to have a higher tolerance for things like pain, isolation, heat, and they required less food and water for a flight. So they were showing that maybe they were going to be a hardier passenger for these flights, and they might be easier for the engineers simply because of the weight. So these two guys sort of thought, like, well, let's just look into the idea. We already have all this data on these men who underwent these three rounds of astronaut testing. So why don't we just put some female aviators through those same tests, see what happens? And so that's what they did. They got a group of women pilots. I should say, Flickinger, as an Air Force man, was booted out of the project pretty early on. The Air Force did not support this idea. And so ultimately, it was Randy Lovelace's to manage on his own. But 13 women ended up getting through these tests with basically passing grades. So 19 women in all underwent these tests. 13 made it out. And it looked very briefly like these women had a chance at pursuing spaceflight, which was this, you know, audacious, unbelievable dream at the time. Of course, the politics of the time soon made that impossible. But what my book talks about is this, like, brief magical moment where these 13 elite female aviators looked toward a career in spaceflight with actual, that looked legitimately possible. And it was this really amazing moment that then turned into heartbreak when politics got involved. There was a lot of sabotage and disappointment.
Yeah. Now, I want to go back to the psychological testing, because there's a story you tell, and this has to do with Jerry Cobb, a very well-known name from this era, from among the 13. She really withstood that testing and actually performed better, I think, than any of the men did.
Right. So Cobb, at the end of her physical testing, which was the first stage of the screening process, received a very high endorsement from the physicians. Basically said, there's no reason why she couldn't be an astronaut. In fact, she has a lot of qualities that would make her an excellent astronaut. And so she went from that phase of testing into the psychological phase of testing. So she looked at ink block tests, took IQ tests, did all of these, like, sort of typical psychological analyses. But what differed from her testing was that when it was time for her to take her isolation test, which I should say is part of being a pilot in a lot of circumstances, is these isolation tests are important because they will identify anybody who has a hard time being in an enclosed space for a prolonged amount of time. You know, like, this wasn't something new that just NASA was doing. The Air Force had been doing these for years because they wanted to make sure that they weren't going to put somebody up in an airplane that had a problem with claustrophobia or isolation. So, as I said, the men who underwent their astronaut testing, they just had to sit in a dark room for a couple of hours. John Glenn wrote poetry. Scott Carpenter did, like, a physics problem while he was in there. But when Jerry Cobb went to take her isolation test, she did something a little different, which was called the isolation tank. This was a large tank of water that had been heated to her exact body temperature, so it made it very hard for her to tell what part of her body was in the water and what was out of the water. In addition, it was in a soundless and lightless room. So what happened was she got into this tank, some technicians put some cushions under her neck and back so that she could float easily, and then they closed the door and waited to see what would happen. And the people who had taken this test prior to Jerry Cobb had had some pretty intense reactions. You know, some people had, they were hearing non-existent voices. They thought they could hear dogs barking. They weren't sure if they were awake or asleep. People were crying. Some people were screaming. It was just an upsetting experience for a lot of people. And Jerry Cobb was so dead set on getting this chance to go into space that she didn't let any of that bother her. And she stayed in the tank for 9 hours and 40 minutes, which was over 3 hours longer than anyone had ever done it. And so when she got out of the tank, you know, the test administrators were baffled, but they were also so impressed because once again, she had shown that she had the stuff that was required for something as isolating and dangerous and scary as spaceflight.
I'm trying to imagine this because I'm guessing that she doesn't even get a clock to look at. She doesn't know how – am I right? Does she know how quickly time is passing?
She had no idea. And that's one thing that's funny is she wasn't the only woman who excelled in this test. Two other women, Rhea Hurl and Wally Funk, both blew everybody out of the water with their performances. In fact, Wally stayed in the tank for 10 and a half hours. And they all just reported the same things. You know, they wanted this so badly. They would stay in that tank for as long as it took. And that is something that you sort of see throughout this testing process. So a lot of these tests were very painful and uncomfortable. For example, technicians would insert like a big needle into the meaty part of a pilot's hand and then pulse it with electricity as part of a test on their nervous system. But it was really painful because you had a huge needle, the women said it looked like a nail, sticking out of their hand, and that was getting electrocuted. So your muscle would tense and sort of pull against this big needle. And over, the technicians were telling the women, like, man, when we had the men coming through here, they were whining and complaining and griping, and you are all so tough. And it was because women did not want to do anything to jeopardize their chances at spaceflight. So, you know, they pretended like none of this hurt. They pretended like none of this was hard. They put on a brave face to show, no, no, we want this. We'll do what it takes. And so over and over, as you read the book, you kind of see this pattern of the men doing things that are hard as a group and complaining about it and sort of being poor sports, but still getting to do these amazing things, fly these incredible jets, eventually get into outer space. And you see the women on their best behavior, projecting an air of professionalism, being so tough, so brave, so stoic, and over getting denied these chances.
Yeah. Well, you've talked about this thing called, I think, the sensory deprivation tank. I also want to hear about the Mastiff, this machine they get inside and they spin around. What was that test?
Sure. So this was actually a training device that was devised by some NASA astronauts for their Mercury 7, because they wanted their astronauts to be ready for something that could possibly happen in outer space, which would be a spin or a tumble. So when you're out in outer space in a space capsule, you don't have gravity or air particles to sort of slow your vehicle down. And what the engineers were afraid of was that, like, what if something happens, a thruster burns on accident or something and sends our little cone-shaped space capsule into a tumble? Because if that happened in outer space, there might not be – it would be very hard for it to slow down on its own. It probably wouldn't slow down on its own ever. So they needed their pilots to be trained to get themselves out of a spin in zero gravity. And so what they did is they used this machine called the Mastiff, which is – it stands for Multi-Axis Space Training Inertial Facility. So Mastiff is better. And it was a set – it was basically a cockpit that sat inside three consecutive rigs. So these structures, a huge thing, it was two stories tall. And each rig would spin the pilot on a different rotation, so pitch, roll, and yaw. So you could be somersaulting, cartwheeling, and twisting all at the same time. And the goal was for a pilot to get so used to being in something like this that he or she could bring it under control, you know, to a standstill in a short amount of time. So the Mercury 7 were the first astronauts to train on this thing, and they hated it, as I think is a very normal human reaction. In fact, Alan Shepard, who, you know, was the first American to fly in space, On his first attempt in the Mastiff, he started it up, immediately hit the chicken switch, which was the abort button, and had to be carried off to a cot by a couple of aides who then gave him a bucket because of, you know, the
obvious
of being
yes.
in something like that. But what's interesting is in comparison, Jerry Cobb, on her first try in the Mastiff, her first day working on it, spent 45 minutes, if you can imagine, 45 minutes on that thing, spinning, twisting, cartwheeling, and she was able to control it remarkably well. And it's just one more piece of evidence, you know, in this folder that's showing that these women were incredibly capable and might have made just as good of astronauts, if not better, than the Mercury 7.
Rebecca Siegel is with us. She's author of To Fly Among the Stars, The Hidden Story of the Fight for Women Astronauts. If these women made the cut in terms of the testing, but didn't make the cut in terms of social acceptance of their campaign to be included among the first astronauts, what did they do next? They apparently started speaking out, and we're going to hear that story, how this entire conversation goes public. After a short break here on our show, I'm Marcus Smith. Stick around for more Constant Wonder. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. We're talking with Rebecca Siegel about her book, To Fly Among the Stars, The Hidden Story of the Fight for Women Astronauts. This is from Scholastic, I understand, the publisher. And so your audience here, it's me, yes, and it's grown-ups, yes, but Rebecca in particular, this is for a middle school audience, maybe?
That's right. So technically it's written for a middle grade audience, so middle school and up.
Well, I think that's kind of beside the point. I love the fact that you're making this available for kids, and yet the story is absolutely one that interests me. And we were just about to the point where I wanted to kind of tempt you to start talking about how all of this is kind of inside of NASA, but then eventually it goes outside, where the women start trying to make their case, I guess, right out in the public eye, in the public ear, Congress, the White House. Tell us how they start to maybe politic for the opportunity.
That's right. So when this project started, it was kept very quiet. These researchers wanted to gather some information on women pilots and their capacity for spaceflight, and then hopefully use it to persuade NASA to admit women into the astronaut corps. But as time passed, and as the Mercury 7 were starting to get their first flights, and as the space race was really taking off, it became pretty clear to these women that NASA was not going to allow them to join the astronaut corps or even be considered as astronaut candidates. And so two of the women who were involved in this program, Jerry Cobb, who we've already talked about, and a woman named Janie Hart, who was an excellent pilot, and she was married to Phil Hart, the Michigan politician. The two of them paired up to go on something of a media blitz to get attention for their cause. They felt like NASA not agreeing to consider them for this opportunity was discrimination. And so they started talking to the press. They got themselves in front of Vice President Lyndon Johnson. And ultimately, they got themselves in front of a special hearing in the House of Representatives on a subcommittee on science and astronautics. And so this was their big chance. Now, it's important to remember what was happening at the time, though. So this was the summer of 1962. Already we had Alan Shepard had flown, Gus Grissom had flown, and John Glenn had just flown. And these guys were glittering celebrities. You know, like, they're the Kardashians, but with no drama. Everyone knew who they were, and everyone loved them. And so you had this hearing in the House of Representatives where these two women were going to come in and argue that NASA was discriminating against them. And what they really were arguing was that they wanted a spot. And so it was a pretty tough situation to walk into, because you also had John Glenn and Scott Carpenter testifying on the other side of the issue. Now, NASA, when they had selected their first astronauts, had set out a list of qualifications that they wanted these astronauts to be able to meet. So they said, we want military test pilots with jet flight experience that had at least 1,500 hours in their flight logs. We want people with a bachelor's degree in science or engineering or the equivalent. And then there were some physical care, requirements. They couldn't be too tall, too heavy, or too old, right? Now, the women were arguing that these requirements were unfair because at the time women couldn't fly in the military, which meant that they couldn't be military test pilots and they also couldn't be military jet pilots. Jets were still pretty new at the time. The only way you could fly a jet for the most part was if you were in the military. So they were saying, like, this isn't fair. NASA has set out a list of qualifications that we simply cannot meet. And we have shown in these astronaut tests that we can hack it, but you have to change these rules for us. So they took their fight to Congress and, you know, spoiler alert, it didn't go well. Everybody was really ready to agree that NASA was on the right side of things because they were already looking toward the moon. So NASA wasn't just thinking about Project Mercury. It was thinking about Mercury, then Gemini, then Apollo. And so in order to get themselves to the moon, they were on a very tight time schedule. They had a tight budget, and they had a list of priorities of tasks they had to check off their list before they could get to the moon. And so when these two women march into Washington, D.C., demanding that the agency stop discriminating against them so that they could have a chance to be in space, it was not something that anybody within NASA wanted to hear. And so what happened, which is spectacularly surprising, was there was this woman named Jackie Cochran. And so she was this famous entrepreneur. She had a cosmetics empire. She was married to one of the richest men in America, but also she had run the WASPs, which was the Women's Air Force Service Pilot Program in World War II, which was this very short-lived program where women got to fly in non-combat missions over domestic skies, military aircraft. And she originally, at the very beginning of this project, had agreed to fund this women's astronaut testing program because she wanted to be an astronaut. And she also loved being in charge of these amazing women-focused programs. However, as time went on, it became clear to her that, A, she wasn't going to be an astronaut. She was too old and her health was not good enough. And B, the spotlight was not on her. It was on Jerry Cobb. And so as time went on, she started to rethink her involvement in this program. And by the time that that congressional special hearing came about, she had changed her mind entirely and decided that she did not support this program anymore. And in fact, she wanted to start a program of her own that would test a lot more women and that she would be in charge of. So as this trial is happening, you have Jerry Cobb arguing her heart out that she deserves a chance in space. And then you have Janie Hart arguing that NASA's being discriminatory against women. And then you have these two astronauts who are celebrities, beloved. Everybody in the trial can hardly stop drooling over them. And these two guys are saying, no, we shouldn't have to change the qualifications to become an astronaut because look how good they are. We're here and we're clearly the best for the job. And then you have Jackie Cochran come in. And Jackie Cochran says, I don't support Women in Space program. I think we need to stay out of the hair of all these male aviators and let them get what they need to do done. After that, then we can look into a program for women in space. And her argument was really attractive for NASA because she wasn't saying no women in space. She was just saying no women in space yet. Like, let's get Project Mercury out of the way. Let NASA do what it needs to do to take those important steps towards the moon. And then when there's time and money and energy, we can bring some women in and see how it goes.
I don't want to be too cynical here, but I'm tempted to say maybe she was put up to this. Maybe she didn't offer this plan of her own accord.
Oh, that's a very interesting suggestion. I don't know if I would agree with that. She, I think, felt confident that she could run her own program after this. Running the WASPs had been very good for her. But, you know, I don't know. You could be right. She had a lot of friends in very high places, and it's possible that someone along the way had whispered in her ear that this would be an easy way.
Yeah, yeah. I like that kind of a story just because of the intrigue that's possible there, you know?
Yeah.
True or not, it's a fun plot line.
Yes. Well, so that's what's interesting about this book is when I first started researching it all these years ago, I thought, like, oh, this is a story of good versus bad. You know, the good would be the women trying to get into space and bad would be NASA not letting them in. And ultimately, it was so much more complicated than that. You know, there are personal stories and personal motivations all over the place. You know, there's people on one side that are doing things that are wonderful for the women and helpful for the women. And then there are people who are on the women's side that are sabotaging the women and taking them back. You know, so it wasn't this simple story of good versus evil. It was a story of humanity, you know, and this cultural race at the time.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is the story of some pioneering women who tried really hard, and with the exception of Wally Funk, who got her chance in July of 2021, the original 13 did not make their way into space. And there's the Jerry Cobb story where she gets a chance again in 1998. But I guess to finish off our conversation today, do you have a number in your back pocket where you can talk about maybe either the percentage of astronauts who have been female, or maybe some kind of a ballpark figure for how many total women have made it into space?
The number's changing all the time, and I'm very happy to say that this is something that I have to constantly be checking, because we've got Blue Origin, SpaceX, all of these private companies in addition to NASA, ESA, JAXA. But over 50 American women have been to space at this point, which is wonderful. However, the numbers of women who have been in charge or who have been in the pilot seat are still quite low. So right when I wrote the book, only about 3% of American crewed space missions have had a woman in the driver's seat, meaning have had a woman pilot. And then less than that, only about 1.6% had a woman commander. So that still is a pretty measly number. I do anticipate that that is going to be changing a lot in the next few years. However, these numbers point to a greater issue, which comes from the world of aviation. So in order to be a space shuttle pilot or a spacecraft pilot, you need to be a pilot. And in aviation, women are very vastly underrepresented. So when I wrote the book, and it might be a little bit different now, only about 7% of aviators in America were women. And so that's just a number that's frustratingly low. And that comes from a lot of different things, cultural and social. But in order for us to have more women in charge in outer space, we're going to have more women in charge on the Earth. And so that's something I think that I hope that we are able to work on. And, you know, just anecdotally, in my own experience, my flight school that I went to here in Chicago, about a third of the students were women, which was really, really good. And I was very happy to see that.
Finally, apart from the specializing in either aviation or astronautics, do you see that there's got to be crossover from other leadership roles that women might have in society at large?
I don't think that we can expect to see changes in STEM fields unless we see a change in the cultural attitude about women in positions of power. So in order for there to be more women running STEM companies and making these advances in spaceflight and aviation, we just need to have a different attitude about women in roles of power. You know, there has to be a shift in comfort with seeing women in the cockpit. There still today is a sense of distrust among airline passengers when they see a woman in the cockpit, which is really hard for me to wrap my mind around that it's 2021 and that's something that we're still having to deal with. But culturally, we have a lot of work to do in order to see a shift of what happens in science.
Rebecca Siegel, you tell a great story, and thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Rebecca Siegel's book is titled To Fly Among the Stars, The Hidden Story of the Fight for Women Astronauts. A related story is on the way here on Constant Wonder. We're going to revisit a conversation with Catherine Goble Moore, one of the daughters of the Hidden Figures hero, Katherine Johnson. Katherine Johnson, the mathematician, confident, humble. She said, if you expect nothing, you'll get nothing. But she also thought she was just doing her job at NASA and was very surprised by all the attention that she got when her story was told to the general public. And eventually she did receive the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Stay tuned for the Katherine Johnson story on Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. We have frequently talked about the ongoing revolutions that open doors for women, granting women access to activities and pursuits that historically were shut off to them. And so on the show, we've talked about women who have become pilots and chemists, political activists, entrepreneurs. It's a great and important story arc for us here on the show. And today we're going to talk up a name that you may very well know already, because the name Katherine Johnson was pushed into the limelight a few years ago in the movie Hidden Figures. And after seeing the movie, I was delighted to learn that Johnson was still alive. And then, shortly thereafter, a few years later, I noted her passing in early 2020 at the age of 101. Now, we talked about Katherine Johnson around the dinner table in our family after seeing the movie, and then again when she died. And several of us were given to remark what a quiet and unassuming hero she seems to have been. Well, today I'm very delighted to introduce you to her daughter. There's great interest naturally in the way Hollywood approaches biography, but there's almost greater value, in my estimation, to speak with the people who can tell their own story in the first person. So, Katherine Johnson's daughter and namesake, Katherine Goble Moore, is with us, and I'm going to introduce her to you in just a moment. Katherine Goble Moore and her sister, Joylette Goble Heilig, grew up during the space race in the 60s, but never really grasped their mother's role completely until years later. Moore spent 33 years working in public education as an educator and a guidance counselor in New Jersey. She currently resides in North Carolina. And working jointly with their mother, Katherine, Moore and her sister created the book One Step Further, My Story of Math, the Moon, and a Lifelong Mission. Katherine Moore, such a pleasure to have you with us.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
I want to ask right off the bat, who was in the driver's seat for this project? It sounds very much like autobiography, but with a little help on the side.
Actually, yes. Mom was still able to answer questions, and we had long talks with the author, and it was an interesting journey, to say the least, because once the movie came out, and of course the questions from people started coming, and we were started to relive our own lives. And we were able to listen to her and then finish it up because, yes, she did pass February 24th, 2020. What a loss. But as far as her story, hopefully it will live on and on. When you're living it, it's just different.
Was this growing up in the 60s really something where that was completely separate from your experience? She didn't talk about it. It was a different world for her, and you lived in a separate world? Or did you have some idea of what she was doing?
No, we actually knew that she where she worked, what she was doing, but not the extent to which it was being done. We read, we listened. And we were a town of people who worked for NASA. So it was, you know, taken for granted. Your mother went to work. She wasn't a teacher, but she worked. She used her math, and she was working on the space program. So knowing that and knowing it's secret work, she didn't come home with papers and charts and those things. But we did know. I mean, we would go outside with her when she knew that there was a satellite up in the sky that we may be able to see, or we'd look at the stars because that was one of her favorite things, to study the stars and their placement in the sky of the planets and, you know, those kinds of things. So our curiosity was started early, and we were not fearful of the night sky. So we did a lot of looking up, and as she started working closer and knowing when certain satellites were being sent up or whatever, of course, reading about it then, we knew the seriousness of what she was doing. So we were connected.
She seemed, in the footage that I have seen of her, to be such a woman of grace and dignity and composure that I just can't imagine her being the type of person that with a great success, say when astronauts returned to Earth successfully, was she the type to celebrate or to show joy, or did she exult, or was she just more demure and quiet about it?
Your second description. She actually was at a meeting up in the Poconos when one of the space shuttles went up, and the women were sitting around and they were so excited about it going up. And she said, "They don't know. I'm just as concerned about it coming back down safely." But she didn't talk about it. She went to the same church for over 60 years, and the people started saying to us after the movie came out and all, "You know, I've known your mother all these years. I did not know that she did all of that." Well, she never talked about what she did. She was interested in what you were doing. Have you done so-and-so? That humility is real. that humbleness, but it did not overshadow her assertiveness in knowing. She knew what she knew, and she was willing to go to bat with her math skills because she learned from the best. She had the best teachers who encouraged her and pushed her, actually. But she was going to major in French and English because she liked the sound of the language. And the math teacher said, if you're not in my class second semester, I'm coming to find you. And so she went, and she said, well, then I'll major in both. I'll major in French and math, which she did.
Do you suppose that you became an educator because of her her own education and her temperament, where she sounds like she, too, was an educator?
Yes and no. Yes, I know it was because of her in looking back. But at the beginning, you know, I wanted to do something different, so I was going to be a physical therapist. And I started teaching as a substitute out in Texas during the war. My husband was in the military, and I noticed how our Hispanic, Mexican-American students were being treated, and the black students in the schools, and it didn't make me feel very comfortable. So I said to the professor, to the principal, you're not going to get good results if your teachers don't like the children they're working with. And that was when I changed my field and went into education, went back to school to finish in education so that when the students looked, they would see someone that looked like them. Because even in the 70s, when I started, a lot of schools were still very slow on integrating. And I was hired. I was the only teacher in a primary unit. So I was the only kindergarten teacher, black teacher, of children in a town that was considered an inner city school. So you can imagine how the need was and how I felt being able to be a part of that.
So this kind of raises the question for me, just how active were the discussions around the family dinner table when you were growing up relative to racial inequities, social inequities, civil rights? Were those topics of conversation that were common?
Yes, but in a subtle way. You see, we still had to walk that fine line. We lived in a black community, and there was a white community down the street just like ours. And it wasn't until we moved out of, you call them the projects today, we didn't. We called them neighborhoods then. But we still had to be safe. And once my father passed, you had a household with four women, and we had to be in a certain place. We had to be home. So if our activities still were centered around church, school, and home, we went to segregated schools all the way through high school. And so a lot of our upbringing was characterized by the world around us. And we didn't fight it. We weren't taught to be angry. We were just taught to do our jobs, be prepared, so when the door did open, we could walk through it with our heads high, because that's what we saw every day.
Did she see herself as somebody who was at the fore of efforts to bring down those barriers?
Probably in her unique way, she felt that if she lived it, you had to see it, and that if she was doing her job, her children would follow. That's the easiest way for me to say it, because she was not a real staunch, you know, fist bumping. She was just a very genteel. She really was. She was a leader. She modeled what she wanted. She had high expectations. She did not bite her tongue as such, but the way she would cajole or suggest was a very caring way, so that you tried to please, you tried to do what was expected, because she would say, expect nothing, you will get nothing.
Did she respond well or with any kind of comfort to the attention that came to her in her last decade or so?
Strange you should ask that. She would say, "What? They want to write a book?" What she was actually saying was, "I was just doing my job." She did what she thought she was supposed to do, and she didn't see it was extra. She thought it was ordinary. Get up, go to work on time, be punctual, be ready, be prepared. And she said, "I was just doing my job." That was one of her sayings.
That's stunning.
We know it now because we've watched her go through this, and then she just accepted with grace all of the accolades. I mean, seeing her up on that stage in Washington was, I mean, we were in tears. She was just as cool and proud of the president, knew exactly where she was and what she was there for, and just amazing.
You're referring to the event where she receives the Presidential Medal, right?
Yes. Two remaining daughters. We lost Connie, and then all six grandchildren, yes.
Yeah. Now, in the subtitle for the book, it says, "My Story of Math, the Moon, and a Lifelong Mission." Would you describe for us what she regarded to be her lifelong mission?
Her lifelong mission, as we look back, retrospect, is what they say, it's always 100%. It's always 2020, and it was to be the best at what she did and to expect the best from those she could impart knowledge to or inspire. She was inspirational. She was motivational. I can give you an example. She was part of a sorority, the Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority, and had been a member since 1934. And she was called a diamond soror. Well, she was once the financial, she was the president, of course, for a period, and then she was the financial person. And for some reason, as the years went and the position left, and then she stopped going to meetings, they would come to her house to meet with her, the financial committee, because she taught them exactly what was to be done, how it was to be done, why it was to be done, and the correct way to do it. And they said to us just recently how they still do it the way she taught them, because it was the correct way.
Well, she was a mathematician,
yes,
all the way till the – did she think like a mathematician? Is there kind of a personality there that you could describe?
Well, we could start with saying when she would leave us at home, you see – we didn't have babysitters and all back in those days. Your neighbor, your community was your babysitter. When we were at home in the summer, we were old enough. You did, because if Miss Sue or Miss Ann saw you outside and you were supposed to be inside, your mother knew it by the time she got home. And she would leave us chores. And we swore that every day she had figured out exactly how long it would take us to do each one. Because she left us just enough to have a little fun, but to have the work done when she got home.
Well, have you reflected on the legacy within your own family, with her posterity? You've mentioned grandchildren. There just must be a tremendous feeling there.
Yes, yes. We have granddaughters now. I have granddaughters. Jolette just recently became a grandmother. But what we do, for instance, when they decided they wanted to do the movie, we knew we could not take everybody. So we figured if we took the grandchildren, who were old enough to really appreciate everything, they could then tell the story to their children. And we followed that through when there were opportunities for the younger ones to go to the birthday celebrations, she had a statue established at West Virginia State they were able to go. They would come and see her, and that was Grandmother Catherine. And she wasn't a, you know, she could no longer play on the floor and all with them, but she'd always have something to ask them, what did you learn today?
Mm.
Or give them a game that had to do with numbers. One of her favorites was called Rummy Cube, because you had to do series of numbers. Again, a way to playfully learn to enjoy numbers. She said that was the key as far as she was concerned. We used to count, how do you add up the license plates as we were passing and travel, because we only traveled in cars in those days. Or, you know, just fun kinds of things, so that when you saw numbers, you got excited. You wanted to play. You thought it was fun. So when you got to school and they said add these numbers, math was one of our better subjects all the way through school. Jolette majored in math, but I went another direction. But I loved math. My son is an IT person, but his skills in math were wonderful. So he and Grandma, he said he'd get on the phone and her first question would, she'd give him a math problem. And he'd have to either work it while they were on the phone or call her as soon as he got it. But she just enjoyed challenging and making them think.
Such a great opportunity to get to know Catherine Goble Moore, whose voice you've just heard. She's one of the daughters of the Hidden Figures hero, the mathematician Catherine Johnson. And together with her sister, Joylette, Catherine Goble Moore has helped to prepare a book of nonfiction for kids. It's titled One Step Further, My Story of Math, the Moon, and a Lifelong Mission. Earlier in the hour, we were talking about another book, also for kids. It's titled To Fly Among the Stars, The Hidden Story of the Fight for Women Astronauts. So imagine you get sick or injured, or you get lost at a national park. What's going to happen? Well, if all goes well, paramedics will get involved. There are paramedics for the National Park Service. They're trained to deal with these situations. Just don't get into one of them yourself. Tomorrow, we're going to hear from a paramedic with experiences at Yellowstone, Yosemite, and Grand Teton National Park. Always great to have you along for Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.